Welcome to the Wildly Capable Podcast by NovoEd, hosted by Todd Moran and Alex Gruen. On Wildly Capable, we explore unusual sources of deep capabilities and unexpected insights on human capital. On this episode, Todd and I interview Adam Neiman, Vice President of Learning and Development at the D.E. Shaw Group. Adam, you have an amazing interdisciplinary background. You went from a computer hacker and coder as a kid, to an art history and art major in college, to multimedia guru, to CD-ROM software engineer, to now VP of Learning and Development at the D.E. Shaw Group. But before we dive deep into your background and some of your experiences in philosophy on learning, we want to ask you about something that you shared with me about D.E. Shaw, where you work now, that so many people who work there with you come from unique backgrounds and have pursued nonlinear paths to get there. You even mentioned that you have a colleague like me that's a playwright. As a starting point, can you talk a little bit about this extraordinarily cool, funky, unique, special, capable organizational culture and how you think interdisciplinarity has a bearing on individual and organizational performance and capabilities?
So I've been very lucky to work in several organizations where part of the hiring strategy is hire smart people and then figure out what to do with them. And Desco is certainly front of mind when I think of organizations that do that. I think there are a few things about that that are sort of interesting in terms of capabilities and sort of the kinds of people you're looking for. I might start by saying that, you know, academia works against multidisciplinarity. I know people who have not gotten tenure who were brilliant because they worked across disciplines and the two departments couldn't talk to each other. And so there are these weird silos. And a lot of academia is sort of designed to keep you in the English department or the history department. And, you know, there the twain shall meet. So when you find people who are multidisciplinary, often they're real self-starters. They're people who sort of are driven to figure things out for themselves. And that is very much the culture here. You know, this is a place where people are hired partly for their ability to sort of figure things out. And you know, we're looking for creativity and we're looking for drive and we're looking for, you know, the ability to operate without so much direction. And so, you know, when I think about our approach to learning, a lot of it is about sort of give people the support they need and then set them loose on interesting tasks. You know, it's interesting when I was about a year after I was hired, the head of human capital shared with me that one of the reasons that they liked me when they were interviewing me was because I told them that it was that classroom training, you know, classroom learning, while it has its place in the sort of arsenal of learning and development, was usually a sort of, a last resort for me. You know, when I think about developing people, I'm much more interested in helping them learn on the job, helping them learn through apprenticeship, helping them figure things out on their own. You know, what's confusing, though, about the multidisciplinarity, though, is I think there are also a lot of misconceptions about it. You know, there's this tendency to say, well, you know, we should teach everybody chess because it will transfer and make you a great strategist. But actually, there's mountains of cognitive science that show that that's just false. It's not that great chess players can't do brilliant things. It's that forcing everybody to do chess, whether they like it or not, is a lousy strategy. It doesn't transfer it well. You know, and the studies show that, you know, chess players, not only do they not become, you know, are they not necessarily better strategists? They aren't even better at memorizing the positions of chess pieces on a chessboard unless they're set up exactly the way a chess game would be set up. So there's this sort of myth of transfer. You know, at the same time, smart people are people who see really interesting connections between things. You know, and that's kind of a fundamental feature of intelligence and how the mind works. And so on the one hand, there's all this evidence in the cognitive sciences that we're terrible at having sort of remindings from one discipline to another. And on the other hand, we know that a lot of intelligence is about doing exactly that. That poses a bit of a conundrum, you know, and I think we sort of wrestle with that. I don't have a great answer for you on it. I think, you know, we think about that a lot. So I think that's really the essence of sort of how I think about interdisciplinarity and sort of how we approach it here, you know, bringing it back around to sort of helping people learn on the job, helping people learn from experiences, and giving them the tools to be real self-starters, because we're hiring people who are sort of, you know, rebellious or something.
Adam, I'd be intrigued if you're talking in the world of academia, and in many ways it's sort of structurally flawed from sort of day one, would you make the argument in the enterprise workspace sort of world that that is also the structure, whether it's hierarchical or four silos tied to I'm in customer success versus product versus engineering versus back office, or is that, you know, starting to sort of be leveled or busted from a silo perspective? What's your take there?
I don't know that I feel like I have a single answer to that. I mean, I think it is certainly the case that jobs are becoming more multidisciplinary, and the pace at which learning is required to succeed in any job is accelerating endlessly at this point. And it's just more and more, you have to understand more and more things. So, you know, if you're in XYZ department and the pandemic comes along and you've got to figure out what to do with that in the face of eight technology changes, it doesn't really matter that you're in communications. You're going to have to understand technology, and you're going to have understand organizational psychology and so on. So I think there is a level at which there's some necessity to that breaking down. And I think organizations are trying to do that. I don't claim to be an expert in organizational psychology, but I do see that happening.
Yeah, which makes me, you know, think a little bit, Adam, about, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about, you know, in NovoEd and amongst our clients is that this kind of core tenet around iterative, around continuous improvement over time. So that, yes, you can be sort of flexible, but this idea of just making a performance insertion with some type of a training activity is by no means going to cut it. And there needs to be this sort of constant, continuous nature. And I think you had some pretty early experiences in your life that, you know, professionally speaking, that, you know, talked to you about the importance of on the job. And you mentioned it in your opening, whether it was, you know, tied to you as a sort of photography student, your time spent at Lehman Brothers and beyond. Can you share a little bit about your philosophy there around this idea of, you know, the importance of iterative, continuous improvement over time, especially kind of in the workforce setting?
Well, I think you're talking about two different things there. I think, you know, one is iterative, right? So the notion that you're constantly practicing and improving and learning by doing, you know, I think that's absolutely fundamental. I think, you know, and that's part of the pain you see in corporate learning everywhere is everybody talks about learning by doing, but it's remarkable how much of it is just people sitting in lectures versus learning on the job. And, you know, and again, this goes back to my point before about, you know, to some extent I was hired because I said classroom is my last resort. You know, iterative happens not in the classroom, right? You know, it's not efficient to build class after class after class after class. You might take a class that sort of is a launching point to then practicing on the job, but all the iteration is going on in the job. So I think that's one piece of it. You know, the other piece, you know, I think is more broadly you're asking about sort of learning on the job. And sort of for me, that has been the journey has been always sort of talking my way into things. I have a number of brilliant women in my life who coach me, but I also coach some women. And there's this weird phenomenon where, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but it is often the case that a man with 50% of the capability will be happy to talk himself into a job, and a woman with 150% of the capability will feel she's not ready yet. I am definitely in the former category. And I try to convince the women who I mentor to do the same. In college, I had the slightest background in photography because my father had been a photographer, but I really didn't know what I was doing. And I talked my way into the advanced photo class because I couldn't get into the introductory one. In the first critique, I got slaughtered, deservedly so. And that sent me on a journey. I spent 40 hours a week for the next 2 months in the dark room until I was really good, you know, and I've repeated that again and again. You know, when I went to Lehman Brothers out of college, I was a glorified secretary and this role came up in multimedia and I didn't really have the skills, but I kind of talked my way into that as well. I networked with the people up there and my boss helped me and I taught myself software, you know, taught myself the software I needed to learn on the side. And I won't belabor the story, but eventually ended up landing a role there. And while I was there, I was doing computer animation for like sales presentations and they started to want to make them interactive. And I'd been a computer hacker as a kid. And I said, I can do that. And they said, well, we'd rather hire a programmer. I said, well, why don't you just give me a challenge and I'll do it. And I was working at night at the time. And so the guy who managed it, managed the group said, fine, I'll give you a challenge and you leave it for me in the morning. And if it's good, I'll give you another one the next day. And every night he would leave me a challenge and I would write some more code and learn some more code. And I won basically, by day after day, everything he threw at me, I was able to do. Finding those opportunities to sort of just put yourself in there and challenge yourself, beyond what you know, I think is so important to developing yourself. I worked with a number of amazing people at Lehman. One of the people I worked with was their head of visual design. And I sort of, while I was there, I also sort of apprenticed myself to him, and it started by just saying, look, can I do the scut work for you? Can I take your, you need photographs cropped and resized for your beautiful animations. I'll go do that for you. And then, okay, well, maybe I could put together some of the screens for your beautiful animations and save you a little more time. Okay, I'll do that for you. Oh, I'm starting to see the patterns in your animations. Maybe I could do a little bit of animating for you. And, and all of this is me apprenticing myself and saying, look, I can do a little bit more of the work and take it off your plate. And, I learned a ton of design that way. I was very, very lucky to be working with people who were so talented and to be able to apprentice myself to them. But as a general rule, that has always been a sort of driving force for me, is trying to find incredible people and learn from them, apprentice myself to them.
Yeah, I wonder with what has been seemingly these last 18 plus months, this massive resurgence or escalation in the criticality of coaching and mentoring in kind of the workforce space. Would you go so far as to say that was more of the formal relationship you had, or it was you finding a way to kind of ask and get that feedback and then sort of insert yourself in that sort of apprentice to model as opposed to maybe a formal coaching and mentoring relationship that seems to be so hot right now and so key to folks feeling like that's the way to sort of develop large workforces?
We invest heavily at Desco in supporting mentoring and coaching relationships. And I think we find great results with that. But I also think that an enormous amount of very powerful mentoring and coaching experiences are entirely informal. Most of mine have been finding somebody who's doing something amazing and saying, hey, can I help you? And every once in a while, there's this notion called the cognitive apprenticeship. One of my graduate advisors talked about it, Alan Collins. And the idea is it's apprenticeship where a lot of what's going on is that the experts are sort of speaking out loud as they're thinking out loud. They talk through their thought process. And so, I try to do that. When I was working with a designer at Lehman Brothers, why are you doing that? Can you tell me, how you laid this out? How did you think about, how the music went with the visuals? And so trying to find those opportunities wasn't my official mentor, but it was amazing. I mean, I certainly have had formal experiences too in graduate school. My advisor was, he's a real intellectual hero of mine. And it's funny because we clashed when I first met him and I swore I would never study with him. And 18 months later, I was his advisee and I did my PhD with him because he had an incredible vision for education. He had an extraordinary way of teaching it. And he really practiced what he preached. I got thrown into a class where I had to develop an educational simulation. And I picked a project that he said I would fail at miserably. And I killed myself to not fail. It worked. I think there are both formal and informal opportunities. I think that people should not wait around for the formal. I guess is the big takeaway. It's find people who are doing amazing stuff. See if you can help them. That they'll become your mentors and coaches, probably.
You just mentioned your mentor there, and that's Roger Schenck. another one of our learning tenets at NovoEd's, safety. And you wrote in a research paper with him that safety and learning is obviously a serious concern, but there's a larger issue than just safety here. It's generally inefficient to throw students into learning by doing experiences without providing them with a variety of supports that'll engage them and help them to learn faster. Can you talk about efficiency metrics and learning safely at scale?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, a lot of sort of poorly designed and haphazard learning happens at the poles of safety. So on one pole is the sort of classroom where there are really no consequences to getting anything wrong except you get a bad grade, you know, which particularly in a corporate context is pretty meaningless. And at the other pole is you're on a serious project and you fail and it's a catastrophe and you get fired. Right? And so you're looking for the sweet spot in the middle. Because if you don't care, you don't learn anything. You know, if there's no emotional context, you know, it doesn't, you know, you don't feel like, wow, I'm doing something meaningful. I'm trying to perform something I actually want to be able to do well. Then failures, so what? You know, it doesn't really get your attention. It doesn't stick. You know, if you think about what's memorable, failure is actually memorable when it's emotional. So I tell people, you know, look, think of two scenarios. One, you knock yourself out preparing for a meeting and you do terribly. Two, you do no preparation whatsoever for the meeting and you do fantastically well. You know, first of all, which one of those is much more intensely emotional? And two, which one are you going to spend the time to learn from? Which one is going to make you stop and say, huh, what happened there? I really need to figure that out. You know, odds are, you know, both of them are sort of expectation failures. Both of them are, gee, I did one thing and I got an outcome that was different than what I expected. But the kind that's a little bit painful is still meaningful. The flip side is failure can't be so painful that it's catastrophic. I mean, you know, the obvious example is you don't want somebody learning to fly the 747 by flying a 747 on their first day. You know, if you're worried about, I'm going to get fired, I'm going to, you know, I'll fall in the eyes of all my colleagues irreparably, that's no good. And so there's, you know, you have to figure out what is the sweet spot of sort of, it's not catastrophic, but it feels meaningful and consequential and you care. You know, so I think that's sort of how I think about that. You know, you were asking about scale, learning safely at scale. I think the first piece of that is about apprenticeship. You know, an apprenticeship is about finding opportunities to practice where there's somebody guiding you and where maybe you're not taking on the most high risk projects, or maybe you're doing the first cut at things and some expert is in the loop so that your work doesn't produce a catastrophe. There's a checkpoint. Some of it is simulation based, you know, so designing simulations for people so that they can practice in the safety of a simulation, which can be emotional if it feels like the simulation is really having you do the kinds of things you want to do. You know, if you want to be a hotel manager and learn how to price rooms, and I put you in the role of a hotel manager and have you price the rooms in a simulation, you'll care. I've been spending a lot of time recently on something I call directed performance support, where you try to design more learning into the process of working. Again, you know, this is scalable, but it's hard to design. You know, you're working all the time. How can we sort of capitalize on the fact that work provides opportunities for learning?
We talk about catastrophic failure, right? I mean, how do you enable that, what you just talked about, that sweet spot, A, in hybrid learning environments, right? So, and we'll talk more about context in a second, but A, in hybrid learning environments remotely, it's one thing if it's a catastrophic failure where an individual employee is embarrassed in front of all of their team members. It's another thing if it costs a company an extraordinary amount of money. So how do you enable safe opportunities to fail in the flow of work so that you can learn on the job?
Well, I mean, I think there are a few pieces to this. First of all, one of those I would not call catastrophic. Embarrassed in front of some of your colleagues is not catastrophic in the way that losing millions of dollars for your company is catastrophic. So a little bit of embarrassment is not a terrible thing. And, you know, I and colleagues I respect have designed simulations where people make presentations in front of their colleagues. And if those simulations went badly, it was a little embarrassing. And that got their attention. It was important. You know, I remember some colleagues of mine built a learning simulation for consultants, and a lot of them were slightly arrogant recent MBAs. And they kind of needed the sort of embarrassing failure to wake up and pay attention and realize that something needed to change. So I don't think, you know, I think there's catastrophic and then there's emotional. What I just described is emotional, but not catastrophic. A lot is made of the technology and the format of the learning and things like that. And you know, people come to me and they ask me for advice about learning design, and they expect that I'm going to talk about how the video should play or which platform to use. And I really, all of that stuff is trivial. It's you know, deck chairs on the Titanic. What matters is, what are you having people practice doing? And are you giving them good feedback? And are you giving them good supports to figure out how to do the things they need to do? And that can be done in a hybrid environment. It can be done in person. Certainly, we've learned lessons from you know, the pandemic about, you know, what is better or worse supported in a hybrid environment. But I don't think it really drastically reshapes what we're doing. It doesn't reshape the amount of safety. It doesn't reshape the challenge. It doesn't really reshape how we should be thinking about designing learning experiences. At the end of the day, the question is, are you getting to practice the things that you need to be able to do? Are you getting meaningful feedback on the work you're doing? And are you getting good supports along the way to help you with your practice? And that's fairly independent of you know, whether it's hybrid, in person, or whatever. I do think, you know, there are some things that are interesting about hybrid around psychological safety. So, you know, it is harder to read people in a hybrid environment, right? And so it's a little scary if you're not sure that you're really getting honest feedback. Like, am I blowing it and people just aren't telling me? And so you do need to think about that. I would say, you know, if I was going to call out one piece of strategy that I particularly think about is sort of how do we deal with it, especially in the hybrid environment, I would say it's that. It's thinking about trust. And how do you build a trusting environment where people can really get honest feedback?
Yeah, the idea of that focus on the consistent practice and application and the core tenets of quality feedback and creating those feedback loops being just like mission critical, irrespective of technology used or modality delivered, I couldn't agree with you more. We preach a lot about that and work a lot with our clients as well. Come back to me for a second, though, on this DPS, because I think that's a wildly important theme that you're talking about, directed performance support. You know, oftentimes this whole idea of in the flow work has gotten conflated with, oh, let's just take learning assets and push them into these productivity tools, and we'll call that learning in the flow work. I think that's all, and that's foundationally different than what you're describing as performance support with practice, with feedback loops. Can you expand a little bit more on that? What does that really look like?
So probably the best way to explain directed performance support is to sort of tell the story of developing it and talk about the context. I need to slightly sanitize for the protection of the innocent, but, you know, I was working for a professional services firm on a project to train sort of, you know, partners in that firm. The problem they were, we'll call it GD law, global and diverse law. And GD law had a pain point, which is Jane is a partner in their employment law practice. So her client Acme gets really well served in employment law. But Acme has all this pain in patent law that Jane can't speak to. And if only Jane knew enough about patent law that she could bring in, you know, she could talk to Acme about patent law, they could bring in patent lawyers from GD law and expand the relationship, and everybody would benefit and Acme's pain would go away in this other area. And people came to me and said, well, you know, why don't you build a simulation? And I said, because I don't see a bunch of partners in a senior professional services firm spending a whole lot of time doing an e-learning simulation in a fictional scenario. And so what we did instead is we said, you know, how could we build this around actually getting their work done? And the solution we came up with was this idea of a client notebook. So the client notebook had a set of 10 questions about patent law. And GD law's approach to it. And if Jane answered those 10 questions, she would have in her back pocket all of the information she needed to go have a great client conversation with her Acme client about GD Law's approach to patent law. And this isn't sort of generic stuff like what are the five pieces of the GD Law framework for patents. It's which two of those pieces are super salient to Acme and why, and where do you anticipate them having concerns, and how would you speak to those concerns, and so forth. And so, you know, the center of this is helping Jane prepare to have this conversation with Acme. And she's really going to do it. This is not some fictional exercise. And to help Jane, we used a MOOC platform. But instead of using a MOOC platform where it's sort of like, well, it's week one, do chapter one and take the test, we said, well, it's question one. Here's a bunch of resources, videos, activities to do in the world, readings, sample documents, whatever. You're a grown-up. Read them, don't read them, watch them, do them, whatever it is. Whatever it takes to help you answer question one effectively, that's what I want to do with that content. And similarly, you know, on through question 10. And so all of the content, it becomes a pull model of learning, right? So Jane knows Jane starts with a task. I've got to answer this question. And then all of the content that Jane is consuming is in the service of how do I answer the question? And so what we did, if you think about a simulation, the simulation has a structured fictional task in it. And in a structured fictional task, you wrap around that a bunch of performance support, you know, how do I help people figure out how to do the task, and feedback. So the sort of this pyramid, the top of the pyramid is the structured fictional task, and the base it rests on is support and feedback. What we did is we replaced the top of the pyramid. So instead of a structured fictional task, we created a structured real task, which is prepare for this call with Acme about patent law. And then we put the same performance support in. And the benefit of the structure part, structuring the task into those 10 questions, is with that structure, I, as a learning designer, am now able to serve up the salient content. So I'm able to say, okay, Jane, we know you're answering the question about the framework and which pieces might be salient to Acme. Here's content about the framework. Here's, you know, videos of your colleagues talking about, you know, typical concerns clients have. Here are sample documents with answers, you know, et cetera, and so on. And it works like that. And so the structure we put around it is structuring the task for them. That structure then becomes useful ongoing because it's no longer a fiction. It's like, hey, here's a good way to approach this every time you have a conversation about patent law with your clients. And so that became sort of the essence of directed performance support. At the core of that, you know, I think this is sort of my last central point about this is what we said at the outset of designing this is, look, if the partners feel like they are preparing to do work, they're being trained to do work, it's a complete fail. It's a non-starter. If the partners feel like you're helping them do their actual work right now, you win. You know, in the end, something like 2/3 of the partners at a, you know, massive professional services firm spent multiple hours in the course of a couple of months voluntarily doing this e-learning, which is a crazy statistic.
And then some, but I think it gets back to the piece you made at the open, which is, you know, do I care about it? And absolutely, if it's supremely connected to and representative, if not my actual work, then yes, I'm going to care immensely about it, I think. And it makes me think about the other piece, and I know you've written a lot about this idea that that, you know, learning in authentic context supports, you know, sort of future recall, but probably far more than that. Maybe the performance readiness that you're actually sort of getting to, and something that we talk a lot about. So in I know you make a point about learning designers must address the context as well as is if not more importantly than the technology. So can you talk a little bit about, like, how do you do that? How do you reconcile these really challenging contexts with, you know, with ever-changing technologies out there?
So I want to draw a distinction, actually, in terms of how we're talking about context.
Please.
There's sort of authentic context in learning, meaning, you know, if I'm going to teach you accounting, I'm going to have you work in Excel and use accounting tools and work on real problems that real accountants solve with the kinds of goals accountants have. Okay, so that's one kind of context. But then there's also organizational context. And here it's probably illustrative to tell a story, which is I built this DPS thing and I had this wild success with it in this professional services firm. And I thought, wow, I've solved the motivation problem in learning. You know, really cocky. And, you know, as go these stories about being really cocky, I got completely beat. I took that to Everwise, which is a company that does mentoring. They find mentors for people, often new managers, but lots of other people as well. So an organization will have 50 new managers, and they'll come to Everwise, which is now part of Torch, or is, I guess, been rebranded and consumed by Torch. And, you know, Torch will find them a, you know, a mentor to help work, you know, work through it. And I was hired to sort of add wrap e-learning and learning, you know, learning supports around that mentoring relationship. So I built a bunch of directed performance support. It was a lot simpler. It was much more focused on sort of simple things that managers might do, like preparing to give tough feedback to a direct report, you know. And so, you know, similar to the client notebook, you might be filling out a bunch of answers in preparation for a real conversation, but they would be answers like, you know, what did the person do? What were the consequences of their actions? You know, what would be a better path for them? You know, those kinds of things. And the people who used it loved it, but practically nobody used it. And the measure of success, particularly for a sort of internet startup kind of business, was how many people are going to engage. And it was pretty painful for me. And I, you know, it was a real, you know, I thought, gee, I solved everything and here nobody was coming. And I spent a lot of time doing research on that. And I realized that, and I guess the fundamental realization is going to shock everybody, which is that people are really busy. Big insight there, I know. And it turns out that if your inbox is really, really stacked, and somebody asks you to try doing something a different way, and you've been limping along doing it the old way, just okay, for a long time, you're not likely to invest the energy, the activation energy to overcome the inertia, you know, to say, okay, I'll change my ways, because that is going to take some investment. And if your manager's not there saying, hey, we really want to see this difference, we want to see you doing it a different way, that doesn't help. You know, what I realized when I went back and sort of, I spent a lot of time researching, why is this not working? I talked to a lot of users and I looked at our business model and I thought about, you know, what I had done for GD Law. And there were some really fundamental differences. You know, at GD Law, people worked in cohorts of 20 and they were sort of egging each other on and they were seeing what each of the others was doing. Managers were, you know, speaking to the importance of the new performance, that, you know, that bringing people into these, you know, from other practices in the business. The leadership of the organization was talking about the importance of this, and there were compensation structures. All of those things, you know, went a very long way to motivating people to invest the time and energy to change their behavior. Torch, formerly Everwise, has a fantastic product. The net promoter score for the mentoring is off the charts. People love it. So, you know, it wasn't a problem with their product. It was a problem with my addition to their product. And it was that they have a model where they don't actually interact with the person's manager at all. The manager's not on the hook to support this. Nobody's really paying attention. It's very, very much a private relationship between the mentor and the employee. And there are benefits to that in terms of privacy and safety and things like that we've discussed, but there are also costs, because if the manager isn't saying, how's it going with that? Do you need more time for that? I'd like to see some of that. You know, you're not on the hook and the manager is piling other stuff in your inbox. And any smart employee is going to focus on what you're being rewarded to do. You know, it's the Upton Sinclair quote. It's difficult to get a man to understand something if his wallet depends on his not understanding it. A lot of it is a lot of the context piece in this context, you know, and sort of in terms of the evolution of my thinking about TPS, comes down to thinking about how do you get the organization to support the changes you want. So it's not about sort of authentic learning environments. It's about context in the sense that the organization is incentivizing the behaviors you want to see. You know, are managers checking in? And so, you know, when we approach learning at Desco now, anything that we feel is going to be, you know, gee, this is going to be a tough change. People are going to need, you know, to really work at it. There's a lot of, you know, reasons they might not want to work at it. We're going to try to engage the managers as well. in supporting the people who are learning, so that the organization is actually, you know, rewarding the behavior it wants to see. You know, the flip side, I remember I worked in pharma sales training a zillion years ago, and one of the clients came to us and said, we are trying to get our salespeople to be more consultative, meaning we want them to spend a lot more time with each doctor they visit, talking to them about the medicine and the science behind the medication and so forth. And, you know, and that's what we want you to train them to do. And I said, well, you know, if you're doing that, they're going to be able to visit a lot fewer doctors. I would worry that they wouldn't be able to sell, you know, move as much product, essentially. They wouldn't be able to sell as many, you know, prescriptions. Or, you know, I can't remember what the metrics are, but it's something like that in pharma. I said, how are you compensating them for that? And I said, well, we're not. We just want them to do it. And I said, well, all the training in the world will not solve your problem. You know, figure out the motivations. And when you've got that right, I've spent a lot of time in my career looking at people hating training, hating learning and development. And they're, oh, I have to go to a training. Oh, this is so tedious. Why? You know, and I swore many, many years ago, I just don't want to be a part of that. You know, how do I get out of that? And so a lot of my time, you know, and thinking about my career, thinking about my approach to design has been about, you know, how do I motivate people? How do I find the things that are really going to engage them? And that is about alignment with the organization, alignment with people's individual goals, where they want to go. You know, all of that context is critically important. You could be the best learning designer and the best simulation designer in the world, and it won't amount to a hill of beans if you don't get the context right.
Yeah, I think L&D talent, HR teams en masse inside large enterprises need to take more of that sort of adjusted mentality, right? Stop just sort of, when can I insert a training effort to address a performance piece and think about what's the alignment to the rest of the org and why does this really matter? Because yeah, it's not, you're not trying to fix people or tell them they're in trouble by inserting a training effort. It should be sort of bettering them and the org, and that starts the alignment, which I absolutely love that perspective.
Well, and it's not just bettering them, it's making them understand that there's alignment between what they want.
And it also has to do with efficiency and agility and speed, right? And I think that's a good segue into asking you about your take on knowledge transmission versus knowledge creation, which is something that you're passionate about, and how those two concepts have been siloed in the past and the importance of knowledge creation now, especially in the never normal. Can you talk a little bit about that, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. My stepmother is in adult learning leadership development on the faculty at Teachers College. And I, you know, she was part of the reason I got interested in adult learning. And when I went to do my PhD and study with Roger Schenck and many other people at Northwestern, I realized that the kind of learning that the people at Northwestern were focusing on is very different than the kind of learning that my stepmom was focusing on. And there's this weird schism in learning. And one way to divide the learning world is between the people who focus on knowledge transmission. It's not literally transmission. It's not literally this, but it's, you know, metaphorically getting out of my head and into your head. I know something. I want you to know it. That's knowledge transmission. On the flip side is knowledge creation, which is really sort of problem solving. A business where nobody has the answer. There is no expert in the solution. You know, so if you think about, okay, how does my restaurant business pivot in a pandemic? There's no expert to that. Nobody's figured that out before. There may be, you know, a few historical examples you can look at for some inspiration, but it's not like there's an answer or an expert who you can call up who will just tell you, go do this. And so an awful lot of learning is really in this knowledge creation bucket. It's figuring out, solving a new problem, which is essentially creating new knowledge, and that is learning. And it's weird to me because what I realized in grad school is that the two camps don't go to the same conferences, don't read the same papers, don't read the same journals, don't talk to each other terribly much. And I feel very lucky to have been able to straddle the two a little bit. I think, you know, to your point, Alex, the knowledge creation stuff is super important now, more important than it's ever been, because things keep changing faster and faster and faster. And so to some extent, as much as anything, you're trying to create an environment where people are agile, you know, and I think some of that goes back to our hiring for multidisciplinary self-starter type people. you know, you're looking for people who can pivot quickly and can figure things out quickly. And the expertise there, you know, it's not that the people in that domain don't have content expertise. It's that their content expertise, rather than being about a particular technical skill, is about facilitating collaboration and facilitating problem solving. They're experts in how do we generate ideas and how do we get people to collaborate more effectively and how do we, you know, create iterative cycles of testing and, you know, new idea generation and things like that. You know, it wanders off into some of the design thinking work as well. And so, you know, I think both are super important. And each can learn from the other. It's not, you still need to learn, you know, your day-to-day technical skills. It's not like a lawyer doesn't need to learn how to write a brief. You know, and somebody knows how to do that. And that's a critical skill. But it's also a critical skill to understand, you know, how to pivot the direction of your law firm when, you know, when the law changes in a way that it's never changed before. I would like to see a lot more conversation between those groups. I try to bring those two sides to bear in a lot of the work I do.
NovoEd empowers organizations to build deep capabilities rather than mere skills through cohort-based learning that drives true readiness to perform on the job. For more episodes of the Wildly Capable podcast, or for more information on NovoEd, please visit us at novoed.com.